council. If you're ready to proceed, so are we.
Please the court, my name is Victor Boog. I'm here on behalf of Marion Stanton to challenge judgments entered against her by District Court Judge Morris Sandsted totaling more than $500,000, and also a judgment forfeiting her inheritance under her mother's trust agreement, which provided for she and her sister each to get 50% of the trust estates upon her mother's death.
But before you get going, Mr. Boog, please help me with the pronunciation, because I do want to get it right.
I wasn't the trial attorney in this case. I think it's Mikovic, but I could be.
I understand. I'm sure I'll be corrected at some point if I'm getting it wrong. And again, I mean no disrespect. I just don't know how to pronounce it.
Thank you. The issues on this appeal, the legal issues, are one, whether the judgments, which were based upon monies advanced to Ms. Stanton by her parents in the 1970s, the 1980s, and the 1990s, were barred by applicable statutes of limitation. Two, whether there was any evidence in the record to support a judgment against Ms. Stanton for over $23,000 in retirement funds, which were received by her mother, Barbara J. Mikovic, from 1997 to 2003, when her mother was handling her own financial affairs, but which funds were not accounted for or could not be accounted for by the trustee that was subsequently appointed and investigated these monies after her death. Lastly, whether Judge Sandsted erred as a matter of law in ruling that Ms. Stanton forfeited her inheritance under her mother's trust agreement when the pleadings in the case confirm that Ms. Stanton made no claim that any provision in the trust document was invalid, and Ms. Stanton had no reason to challenge the trust since it divided the trust estates evenly between she and her sister. Going to the judgments against Ms. Stanton.
Before you launch into your legal argument, Mr. Boog, I'd like you to address this question quickly.
Okay.
The trial court made very clear credibility determinations in this case. And to the extent that they are supported by the record when we're talking about issues of fact, we must basically defer to those.
I'm well aware of that, Your Honor, and my arguments are based on law, not credibility, not disputed facts.
So you're saying that those findings have no bearing on your arguments?
I think that while I'd like to contest those findings, I'm well aware of this court's jurisdiction on appeal, and that's not why I'm here. And if I might proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
$313,000 of the judgment against Ms. Stanton was based upon $32,000 furnished by her parents in connection with an Ithaca Street residence occupied by Ms. Stanton. $16,000 of that amount of money was tendered in 1974 as part of the purchase price, and title was taken in Ms. Stanton and her mother's name as joint tenants. In 1983, her parents funded the payoff of mortgages on the property, first in April of 1983 in the tune of a little over $10,000, and then in October of 83 for an additional sum of just over $6,000. Between 1974 and 1983, no action was brought to recover any so-called loans. And Judge Sandsted found, with respect to the 1983 advances, that they were loans, and in the 1974 advances, he said as follows, and I'm going to quote here. The 1974 advance was, quote, either a loan secured by BJM, that's Barbara J. Mikovic's joint tenancy interest in the property, or was for the purchase of Barbara J. Mikovic's joint tenancy interest. Okay, so no claim was brought on these advances in 74 within 6 years. Indeed, no claim was brought within advances of $10,000 in April of 1983 before the death of Mr. Mikovic in August of 1989. No claim, in fact, was made on these alleged loans until 2007, when Ms. Weidman claimed that she was looking through her parents' papers and discovered that the loans had not been repaid.
Well, wasn't it a matter of not just looking through the papers? It was looking through the papers because Ms. Stanton had demanded that she do an accounting?
Ms. Stanton had never, that's what the judge said. Ms. Stanton never asked for an accounting back into the 70s or early 80s. But even if she had, what difference does it make legally? The fact is, these papers were in Ms. Weidman's control and custody from at least 2003 on. They were in Ms. Barbara Mikovic's control from at least from the time her husband died in 1989. And Judge Sandstead found, based on testimony by numerous people, that she was lucid and in control of her finances up until 2005, from 1989 to 2005 on.
Mr. Boob,
what evidence was there in the record that between 1974 and 1989, when father passes away, Barbara Mikovic knew about these loans?
Well, they were from her joint account. But even if she didn't know about them, her husband certainly knew about them.
I understand that. I'm just asking the question, what evidence is it that she knew?
She was dead by the time this case went to trial. So she couldn't testify about what she knew or didn't know. And there was no real competent evidence as to what she knew or didn't know. Only what she certainly could have known through reasonable diligence had she chosen to do it on the assumption that she may not have known. So Mr. Mikovic dies in August of 1989. No claim has ever been brought to recover any of these monies. There's no other basis for staying or tolling a statute of limitations.
Mr. Boob, the Judge Sandstead made his findings, if I'm correct here, at pages 21, 22, et cetera. When did the statute of limitations begin to run? And did Judge Sandstead make any finding in that regard?
He basically said it never started to run. His argument was that this was a loan without a due date, thus it was due on demand. No demand had ever been made, so it never started to run. It hadn't started to run today, according to Judge Sandstead. That's not consistent with the law in Colorado, however. The law in Colorado, under the case of Samples-Ehrlich v. Simon, cited in the briefs at 876 P. 2nd 111, is that when you have an obligation such as a loan without a due date, the cause of action accrues on the date the loan is made.
How do you square that with the law that the trial court relied on, of which your opponent relies on, the Thompson case and some other cases, which seem to say that where there's no due date, it's a demand agreement, and that if the cause of action accrues on the date of demand, which can be the filing of
Let's go back a minute to the case that was cited first by Mr. Holliman in his proposed findings to the judge, which were later adopted. The case the judge relied on was Van Diest, D-I-E-S-T versus Towle, and I don't know if I pronounced it right, but it's T-O-W-L-E, 179 P. 2nd 984, 1947. That's a very interesting explanation of the law by then Judge Mortimer Stone, who I had the privilege of knowing before he died. And Mortimer Stone, quite frankly, clearly set forth that a number of things are true. And one is that where there is an obligation that is no due date, it is due when the loan is made or the obligation is undertaken, and it runs from that day forward. And he goes through all the exceptions to that rule, acknowledgement that this debt was due after it was incurred, and he says it has to be in writing. That's the law under the case, the 1994 case of this court, Samples versus Ehrlich versus Simon. He goes into the other issues about Judge Sandstead said, well, we had conversations about this stuff. Conversations don't cut it.
I thought that was only with respect to the 97.
That is, only with the 97. The earlier case.
This is a promissory note.
Yes.
Okay, so is the Van Dees case a promissory note case?
They're not promissory note cases, but the analysis is this. When you have a cause of action that accrues at the time the obligation is incurred, it doesn't matter whether it's a promissory note or it's a contract or whatever it is. The fact is it accrues on the date the loan is made. I admit that the Samples Ehrlich Simon case is a note case, but I think the principle is the same, whether it's a note or whether it's a contract or whether it's found to be a loan as found here by Judge Sandstead. Otherwise, there is no statute of limitations. It can go on for centuries. That isn't the law in this state, never has been.
If there's a single payment loan, balloon payment loan,
right,
and the balloon's not due for 5 years, certainly the creditor can't sue before those 5 years.
Exactly. But that's where there is a due date expressed in the loan itself.
Okay.
Here, there was no due date. So the law says it's due on demand, and demand, the action accrues at the time it's given.
Why isn't there a difference between negotiable instruments like promissory notes and a loan agreement that, an oral loan agreement? I agree to loan you X dollars, and we do it orally. Why isn't there a policy difference between those two kinds of cases?
I'm not sure I appreciate the statute of limitations and when it starts to run under the UCC or secured transactions. What I do know is that on deals such as this, when somebody says it's a loan and there's no due date, I submit to you that the applicable precedent in this state says it begins to run forthwith the minute you get the money. Otherwise, there's no way of saying it ever runs. And one of my facetious arguments in my brief was we shouldn't even had a judgment in this case, according to Judge Sandstead, because there was no demand, and therefore it was never owed. And or it may have been owed, but it was never due, and no judgment should have entered.
But we have cases that say those kinds of situations, it begins to run when a demand is made, and a demand can be the filing of a lawsuit.
Those cases are cases where there is an express requirement as a condition precedent. There is no such express condition precedent in this case. That's the difference. The other thing that Judge Sandstead said was, well, there was fraudulent concealment. Not just concealment, but fraudulent concealment.
Which claim are you talking about?
I'm talking about the one with the Ithaca 3 property, and I think he used that analysis all the way through on all the other loans that he found. Fraudulent concealment, first of all, you have to have concealment in the first place. Here, there was no concealment during the lifetime of while Mr. and Mrs. Mikovic were alive. And all but one of the loans on the Ithaca Street property, the so-called loans, had already expired. It was more than 6 years had gone by. The other thing is that fraudulent concealment is something where two things happen. First of all, there has to be something that prevented the person who was entitled to recover from learning about these matters. And so the case that was cited by the judge, Sandstead, was a wrongful death case involving an airplane, and the manufacturer of the airplane had all the test results, had all the engineering drawings, had all the documents from which you could determine that this airplane was defective. They weren't in the possession of the person who wanted to make the claim. Just the opposite is true here. Mrs. Mikovic and subsequently her daughter Carolyn Weidman had at all times the records necessary to make these claims, And indeed, it's proven by the fact that she made the claims based on a review of those very records. So there was no basis for tolling the statute. And once again, the statute begins to run even when there's fraudulent concealment, when a person discovers or in the exercise of reasonable diligence could have discovered facts forming the basis of the claim.
Pardon me, Mr. Boog, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Sir, you don't have to leave. You can stay here for other counsel's argument.
Senior Mall.
Okay.
May it please the court, Your Honors, I represent Carolyn Weidman, who was the trustee of the Mikovic Trust. My name is Kirk Holloman. I'd like to note, first of all, that in the opening brief and also in the trial court below, no argument was ever raised by the appellant that there was no evidence that a condition precedent, that demand was not a condition precedent or was a condition precedent. That's a new argument raised now. I'd like to also address the issue of when the statute of limitations starts to run on a demand obligation versus a negotiable instrument. I think the law is different. There's an exception for a negotiable instrument, and this is based on the UCC provision, which says that for a negotiable instrument, no presentment is necessary, and it starts to run without the necessity of a demand. But that statute does not apply to anything other than negotiable instruments, and the case relied upon by the appellant, Samples v. Ehrlich Simon, relates to negotiable instruments, as do the other two cases that are mentioned by the appellant, and I believe are also mentioned in the Samples versus Ehrlich Simon case, where you have a legal obligation that's due on demand or that has a demand as a condition precedent. Other than a negotiable instrument, demand has to be made in order to start the statute of limitations to run. And the cases in the, are cited in there, the one Judge Sandstead relied upon, as well as the two others, Stice v. Peterson, I believe, and there's, a Bowman case that's cited in the brief. So in this case, there's no evidence that a demand was ever made. The appellant never argued in the opening brief that Judge Sandstead was incorrect in that finding. The sole basis for the argument that the statute of limitations did not or did run on these three or four loans made before the death of Mr. Mikovic is the Samples Ehrlich Simon case. And the appellant argues that there's no showing that Ms. Weidman or her mother were prevented from bringing these claims by any conduct of the appellant. And of course, Mr. Mikovic died. There's evidence in the record that Barbara Mikovic was not involved in the finances. She never didn't have a checkbook until after his death. Mr. Mikovic was an old-fashioned gentleman, did not involve the wife in the finances. Ms. Stanton described him as patriarchal, that type of thing. So there's every reason to believe that Barbara Mikovic didn't know about these loans. And let me just point out now, there was no argument in the opening brief that Judge Sandstead's conclusion that these were loans was wrong. That was just raised in the reply brief.
Let me interrupt. I apologize. Let me interrupt you for just a little bit, because on these, on the seven loans made by Mr. Mikovic, the father, isn't the critical issue here the legal one about when the statute begins to run? Because if you're right that the statute doesn't begin to run until demand is made, then All the findings that the court made about estoppel once dad dies, seems to me those don't matter. On the other hand, if your opponent is right, that the statute begins to run when the loans were made, then at least six, maybe all seven of them ran out before dad died. And so estoppel wouldn't matter after that. So I'm trying to understand, isn't that on these seven loans the critical issue that we have to decide? And is there anything else really that matters?
I think that in some of these loans, the later ones made in 84 and perhaps 83, even if you took the appellant's argument that the statute begins to run when the loan was made, you would get to Mr. Mikovic's death before the statute would run, and then you have the tolling argument that these were concealed. The earlier loans, we don't know what the instruments or what the documents say because the appellant took them.
Well, we don't have any documents.
That's right. And the court, and so the appellant's trying to take advantage of the fact she removed these documents, and there's evidence there should have been documents because there was a note by the father, Marion, to sign promissory note with the 1983 documents, Exhibit 47. We know the two checks of $5,000 and $7,000 in the 1984 loans were loans because there's a notation on each of them, personal loan made out to Marion Stanton. The father wrote personal loan, Exhibits 44 and 45. We don't have documents for the 1988 loans or the earlier loans. We do have a letter from the father that using our money and yours, you can buy the Ithaca property. So we don't know what the dates for payment were or whether there were any. By the way, the argument that the statute of limitations has to run at some point if a demand isn't made after reasonable time has only been raised again in the answer brief of the, or the reply brief of the appellant. It was not raised below for Judge Sandstead. These arguments were not raised below. It was reasonable under this situation for a demand not to have been made by a father, perhaps. Court could have found that had the argument been raised below. Certainly reasonable that a demand wasn't made if Barbara Mikovic didn't know about these loans. They were concealed from her.
Mr. Holloman,
yes.
When you say concealed, I mean, is there evidence of the record that somehow or another Mrs. Mikovic was prevented from learning about these by the conduct of Ms. Stanton?
Yes. Two things. First, she had a duty. The judge found a duty to disclose these loans, and that was not appealed. And then the concealment issue, that was not raised in the opening brief that she didn't have a duty. And then the concealment issue, there was circumstantial evidence from which the court can infer that there had been concealment. Ms. Weidman testified about the fact there were a bunch of papers that were all scattered around the father's desk after Ms. Stanton had visited one time, that she her suitcases were much bigger and she had trouble getting them into the car than they had been when she arrived. It appeared she had taken documents. We have the fact that Exhibit 47, the father's note, Marion to sign promissory note or to sign note that accompanied the 1983 bank statements that showed the father paid off the mortgage for Ms. Stanton. We have that note, Marion to sign note, which indicates there should have been a note. We have the practice of the father in documenting loans, which was testified to by Ms. Weidman, it's cited in the record, as well as the fact there have been promissory notes for each of the daughters on other homes they had bought. So there's circumstantial evidence from which Judge Sandstead could reasonably find that the appellant did conceal evidence of the loans. Then we have the appellant testifying in her deposition as late as May 31 of 2006 with respect to the 1997 loan that she had repaid it, when in fact the evidence showed at trial that she had not fully repaid it.
Let me ask you a question about the 1997 loan. One of the things that the court found with respect to that, and seemed to have made several findings with respect to that loan, but one of them was that when Carolyn Weidman became the trustee in, it was like early October of 2003, that Marion Stanton fraudulently concealed the existence of the loan and her obligation to repay it from that time on. In October 2003, when Carolyn Weidman became the trustee, what evidence in the record was there that Marion Stanton knew at that time that Carolyn Weidman was now the trustee?
I don't recall if there is any evidence in the record other than testimony by Ms. Weidman that she had assumed that role, and I think she said she believed her sister knew about it. But other than that, I don't recall of any direct evidence in the record about Ms. Stanton knowing at that time that Carolyn Weidman had become the acting trustee of the trust.
Let me ask you one other question about the 1997 loan. It appears to be undisputed that a $5,000 partial payment was made in, it looks to me like early November, before that note was actually due.
Yes.
By its, if that's all you had, if all you had was the partial payment and nothing else, none of these conversations, none of the other things that the court relied on, if all you had was the partial payment prior to the time the note was due, does that have any legal effect whatsoever on the statute of limitations?
No, if it was just that by itself, I wouldn't think it would.
And you don't argue to the contrary.
No, but in this case, we have a situation where Marion Stanton became the trustee of the general partner, the MMSLLP, which was to get 50% of the assets. And as of May 1, 1998, I would argue she had a fiduciary duty under that capacity to disclose her loan. And the Judge Sandstead found she had duties in equity and good conscience to disclose the existence of these loans. Ms. Stanton testified that her mother trusted her. We have plenty of evidence, I believe, that would impose on Ms. Stanton a duty of disclosure, a fiduciary duty, that she did not fulfill. And the fiduciary duty required her to make these disclosures, so even if she had not overtly concealed documents by taking them away, still she had a duty to tell her mother about these loans her father had made, especially when she's involved in helping Barbara Mikovic set up this trust.
You switched gears on me a little bit. I'm just asking about the 97.
I'm sorry. I do think the fiduciary, the duty of disclosure applies to the 1997 loan to Ms. Weidman, and Weidman could not reasonably have been expected to have discovered it between October of 2003 and the time she filed the claim. Her mother had a leg amputated in the fall of 2003. She was busy caring for her. These documents were the last thing she was worried about. She didn't, the record shows she didn't know where her mother kept all her documents. They were just trying to keep the lady alive to care for her. And it was only after Ms. Stanton demanded, I want an accounting back to 1999, 1998, then back to 1989, that Ms. Weidman had reason to start going around the attic, finding boxes, going through them all. And then she stumbled onto things which, after a great deal of study, showed her that it looks like loans were made. And she could not find any promissory notes.
Can I switch gears for a second and ask you about one of the other claims? On the loan claims, there's some evidence in the record, it appears to me, that these were in fact loans. One of them, you have a promissory note, and on the loans from the father, you've got checks and other things, at least given an inclination that these were loans rather than gifts. I want to switch to the retirement income claim. Assuming that Barbara Stanton got this money, what evidence is there in the record, if any, to overcome the presumption that they weren't gifts?
Well, she did not argue in her opening brief that these were gifts.
Yes, she did.
Did she?
Unlike the loans, she did.
Okay, I stand corrected then.
So what evidence is there?
Just it would be her duty to disclose rather than the gift argument. I'd say that she she had a fiduciary duty to disclose all the loans or money she got. She didn't disclose it, and so without disclosing it, you couldn't determine if they were gifts or not, would be our argument. She never made these disclosures.
Counsel, counsel for Ms. Stanton says that these are all issues of law and the court's findings of fact don't make any difference. Do you agree with that?
No, I think the court's findings of fact are very important here, and credibility was a major issue on the imposition of a fiduciary duty, a duty of disclosure. Her credibility is important. Whether or not they were loans, which they're now trying to argue they weren't, would be an issue. I think credibility was a key factor here for Judge Sandstead. He heard this case for 13 days.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.